Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is your host, Pengfei Zhao, speaking to you from Gainesville, Florida. Today, I will be talking with Joyce Newta on her new book, English Learners at Home and at School, Stories and Strategies, published this year by the Harvard Education Press. The book sheds light on the lived experience of English learners. It does this in a very innovative and inspiring way. The main body of the book includes six compelling stories, each centering on an English learner's immigration and educational journey. So when I was reading this book, I was first drawn by the stories. How the life of immigrant families unpacked in the United States, a country that was completely new to them. Then I realized there are so many more there beyond one or two families. It's about the challenges that immigrant children and families often encounter, as well as their resilience and diligence. Many of these families also came from disadvantaged minority social groups. It is also a love letter to those teachers who have done so much above and beyond their assigned job responsibilities to support these children. So I'm super excited today to talk with Joyce, not only about the book itself, but also her passion and her dream expressed through this book. So please join me in the conversation with Joyce Newta, the author of English Learners at Home and at School. Hello, Joyce. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, congratulations on publishing such an engaging and inspiring book. I very much look forward to having this conversation with you about it. Let's get started with maybe first of all, with your self-introduction, let our audience know a little bit about yourself and your work.
Sure. I'm a professor of teacher preparation at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. And I've been at UCF for almost 15 years. And I've been a teacher educator for 20 plus years. Before that, I was a teacher. I worked with immigrant students who were learning English as a second language from all different grade levels, from preschool all the way up through adult, and absolutely loved it.
Wow. Is that how you came to the study of English learners?
Well, in a way, yes. Yes. I have to go back farther than that tell you my personal connection to it started when I was 13.
Wow.
When my parents and I moved from the west coast of Florida to a very small town in the Italian Alps. And my parents placed
me. Oh, really? Wow. Yeah.
And they placed me in an Italian speaking high school, even though I didn't know any Italian and we had never spent time in Italy before. So it was really a life changing experience for me because I had been a very good student before we moved there. My parents were older and they sort of semi-retired. And so this was a reason that we went. And once I started school there, not knowing the language, it became really apparent that that I was in trouble, that the teachers there had never experienced having a student who didn't know the language of instruction. And so they didn't know how to help me. And even though I had been a strong student before, I ended up failing the ninth grade.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then repeating it again, at which point I had developed some fluency in the language from having lived there a year. But the high stakes tests that they had at that time, which were all essay tests and were graded for grammar and style, et cetera, as well as the content, I could not reach the grades that I needed to be able to continue in high school. And the teachers there and a counselor had suggested that I consider another pathway to a career, such as housekeeping or something that wouldn't require a high school diploma, because they didn't believe that I had any potential since I wasn't able to pass my classes. So fortunately, my parents realized that this little experiment of living abroad needed to come to an end. And we moved back to Florida. And at that time, there were a lot of Southeast Asian refugees that had moved into the city where I was from, St. Petersburg. And many of them were at my high school. Somehow, I had an empathy for some of what they were going through. Certainly, I didn't have the struggles and difficulties that they did as refugees, but I understood what it was like to learn in another language while you're learning that language. And I started helping them. And that led to me eventually becoming a teacher of English learners, and then a teacher educator and researcher about English learners and second language learning.
Well, thanks for sharing that. Now I can see this is really like a long-term passion for you.
Yes.
And I can see, you know, why this is your profession. And it's such an interesting story, because like, it feels like you were in those students' shoes before. And you were, I mean, I don't know if at that time, people in Italy, they had a term called English learner, but it sounds like you were an English learner in Italy, right?
Right. I was an Italian learner. And
No,
they didn't have any term for that. And they really didn't know what to do with me. I mostly was sitting back in a corner of the classroom by myself. And occasionally, you know, I'd be given a blank page of paper to write my test answers on. And I'd turn it back in with not much on it. And I think they just gave up on me. And I often ponder what my life would be like if I hadn't had the affordance to be able to go back home and to learn in a language that I know very well. And so I relate to these students because I know that language can make such a difference in the life of a student.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that really shows us how much a student's opportunities for a better life is tied with, in some circumstances, tied with their language proficiency, right?
Yes, absolutely. That's a message in this book that I hope comes through, and that there are, of course, good reasons why it's important for students to know the language well, to use the language well, but we also can't let it become a barrier for them to achieve. And so teachers in particular can make a huge difference if they are informed and prepared to work with these students.
Yeah, see, like, I think that's really like a good place where we make this shift from your story to this book. And I think you summarize it so well that, you know, the stories and how you present the stories in the book just showed us vividly, you know, how important it is for educators to understand their lives and their lived experience. You know, I mean, the English learners. But I know, you know, for this podcast, we are really like trying to introduce the book to a wider audience. And mm-hmm. I know English learners is a term that commonly used by a lot of educators, but maybe not for many of our audience. So maybe you could give us like a brief orientation of who are those students that you refer as English learners and what shared characteristics they have.
Yes, there are so many terms that are used for students who have commonalities with the students that I'm focusing on in this book. There are terms such as dual language learners, multilingual learners, emergent bilinguals. And then there's this federal term. It's actually a term that's in federal statutes that describe a student in pre-K through 12 and into community college, college level, who are residents of the U.S., who have proficiency in English that is developing, and that it is not at grade level yet. And so that, in a nutshell, qualifies them to be considered English learners. So they are still acquiring the English language while they are learning all the subjects in their program of studies at whatever level, pre-K through post-secondary, in the language that they're still learning. So it's kind of a technical term. And I grappled with using other terms that that people might be more familiar with. But I really wanted this book to be clear that we're talking about language in a very particular way, and that it's a major focus of this book in terms of these immigrant students and the immigrant families that these students come from, the role and issues related to their acquiring the English language during this process.
I see. So it sounds like the English learners, this part, like this group of students, are a hugely diverse group, and they may come from like very different life paths or cultural backgrounds. I wonder, you know, that just makes me wonder, you know, how challenging it would be for teachers, educators to support such a diverse group. Because like, it feels like it's almost impossible to, I don't know, to talk about this group of students as a group, except that they all need to learn or improve their English.
Yes, I said in the book that there's as much diversity among them as there is diversity between them and...
Yeah, I noticed that part. Yeah, I was like, this is a very interesting statement.
Yeah, children who grew up speaking English because they can come from all different socioeconomic levels. They can have had previous education that was very strong. They could have had interrupted previous education. They could come from different language backgrounds. So many different factors that fall under the term English learners. And I wanted to make that clear in the book through having the diversity of stories and cultures and languages and contexts. But what's different for students, and this comes through in the stories as well, is there are program models in schools that are intended to support these students, some models that are effective and well known in education are dual language programs, which a number of the stories talk about. And these programs actually use the home language and the English language in instruction, usually in a ratio of at least 50% of each, sometimes a greater percent of the home language. And so these work really well when students, when there's a large number of students in a certain location where you can provide these resources to this group. But sometimes we have students who immigrate into an area where they're the only person or the only family that speaks the language where they're from. That was in a story about a refugee girl in the book called Divanesha.
Yeah, Divanesha, you know, yeah.
the dual language option wasn't really there for her to learn from her in her home language, but she was placed in a dual language school, a school that had a dual language program. And even though she wasn't in that dual language program, the value that was given to bilingualism and multilingualism at that school by offering a dual language program cut across all the different classes and elements of the school. So that's a really critical part, is that the schools value and consider the students' language and cultural backgrounds as assets. So dual language is a particular model, the kind of support that they get. There are English as a second language type programs that are provided in other schools that don't have dual language, or sometimes in schools that also have dual language. And this is a bit of a traditional model where there's a group of teachers who are experts in teaching English as a second language, and they spend time with students in the classroom with their classroom teacher, co-teaching, or sometimes they work individually with the students outside of class time. And that is a model that's used in many places that have students that come from very different language backgrounds. And then we have our sink or swim approach, which is like what I experienced in Italy, yeah. sink or swim in an Italian school. And,
right.
and so this is something that I have been working to help teachers overcome, help teachers and administrators move on from and provide support for these students, because it makes an enormous difference in their achievement and in how quickly and how well they acquire the language of instruction and the language of assessment. So I do not recommend the sink or swim approach, but I will work with schools and teachers that have that approach to try to help them to provide every kind of support that's possible.
Well, this is so interesting. I mean, when you started to talk about those programs, I can immediately feel or get to know how much knowledge you have in this domain. And then also, from, you know, I'm more like an outsider of this field, I could immediately see that, you know, at American schools, like institutional-wise, maybe a little bit better prepared for those English learners. I don't know. I mean, what kind of institutional arrangements those English learners need to go through when they started their education journey here in the United States?
I think there's just a lot of difference between one place to another. And, you know, it even within the same town, there can be a lot of variance. And even within the same school, a point that I made is that you can be in a school that overall does a very good job of working with English learners, but there can be one teacher who really isn't quite there yet that
right.
can affect yeah. a student very greatly in that year that they're together. Or, you know, you could have a wonderful teacher at a school that maybe the school's policies and practices in terms of how they support English learners isn't adequate, but you have a teacher that has a lot of knowledge and skills and passion for it that's there. So sometimes it's haphazard. And my work as a researcher and a teacher educator has been to sort of stratify these different levels of support and receptivity to English learners and attempt to raise each one up through support that will work with the context that they have. I feel for every individual student who is in this situation, who has a teacher that doesn't know how to help them, or who is at a school that doesn't have any policies or practices in place to help them. I feel deeply for that student. And many people in my field use an argument that English learners are an increasing presence in our schools. And there's an estimate there are about 5 million English learners in the US.
Wow. That's but a large
that
number.
Argument, you know, that argument is important, and we absolutely need to be prepared for the volume of English learners, but we have to remember that it's each individual child deserves a teacher who knows how to provide the best education possible for that child, given that child's needs. And so that's going to keep me busy working in this field for a really long time, because there's always someone who needs guidance and help and support in working with English learners in their classrooms or in their schools.
Absolutely. With that, I can't wait to jump into this book. You know, I feel like we have already set up a really good stage for us to talk about the book, because like now we have a better understanding of how important and urgent this issue is. And it's both on the individual level, it just matters so much to those English learner students, also, you know, on the, as you said, the program level and institutional level, in terms of those, you know, resources that the whole society needs to put into schools and communities to support them. So mm-hmm. I want to ask you, like, what do you hope to achieve in this book?
I wanted to expand the reader's compassion for the students and the families in these stories, so that would transfer to a greater compassion for and understanding of students who might be similar, who end up in their classrooms or their schools. I wanted to do it as a gentle nudge, prescriptive approach, but really to put in the stories relatable events and characters, and that they would perhaps see their own students in these stories and realize they don't know a lot about their English learner students and their families. Perhaps, maybe they do.
Right.
And if they do, that is wonderful, and I commend them. But there's a concern in education often that teachers can be quite different from their students, from their cultural background, and therefore there are things they don't understand. I think this is another manifestation of this. And it can be extremely different, the backgrounds that these children and their families come from in terms of what they think about the role of the teacher and the student, how they view their students' future potential and what they should be doing to prepare for it. There are just so many differences, and it's important for the teachers to, first of all, gain some curiosity from reading these stories and seeing how different things can be, but also how many similarities that they can gravitate toward to feel grounded and not completely awash in everything being different and diverse, but something, a thread that runs between all these stories, multiple threads that run between these stories that they can connect to. And for example, the parents' sacrifices and their vision for the future for their children. That's a theme that cuts across all these stories and something that they can be thinking about too when they interact with their own English learners and perhaps in parent conferences, ask a couple questions about that. And they might be surprised what they find out.
Right. Yeah. Now, as I, as you were talking about, you know, those themes that cut across the different stories, I can see definitely, you know, parents all sacrifice so much and they all have such a brave spirit. Mm-hmm. Like to bring their children to this completely new country.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I want to ask him about is that I found it super interesting that in order to achieve this goal that you set for this book, you are mainly telling stories. And the major body of the book is made of 6 stories, each featuring one English learner and their family. The English learners featured in the book at different ages and stages of their, you know, education and speak different languages, and their families migrated to the United States through different channels. So why storytelling?
Well, I've written a number of books that were very instructive. And as I continued writing books intended for educators, I wanted not only to reach their intellects, but to reach their hearts. And I found as I was progressing in my craft as an author for educators, I began to incorporate short little snippets, vignettes or stories about students in the materials that were textbook oriented on teaching methodology and so forth. And I found that the teachers really connected with these little vignettes. And in the teacher education program that I'm part of, there became a vocabulary of the students' names across courses, and even other faculty would begin to talk about, in this case, Edith, Edgar, and Tassir, 3 students that were in a previous book that was very focused on teaching about methodology, and the stories were in the background. And it was so exciting to see that we had built something that connected across this teacher preparation curriculum. And it enabled our teacher candidates to have a different way of approaching how they planned instruction, how they taught in experiences in a real classroom or at the university and in micro teaching, when they actually thought that they were preparing their instruction for a classroom that included these characters that were in the previous book. They cared more. They wanted to be, it wasn't an abstract thing anymore. Oh, here's the five things you need to do to make sure your English learners are getting their needs met. Instead, it was, I need to make sure that this little girl that I've learned about isn't going to sit there lost. I need to make sure that this young man is being challenged enough to his level of challenge so that his proficiency grows and so that he's able to be reclassified. And it just put a different goal to all of the work that they did in the courses. And so I got asked a lot, we love these stories. Can you give us more stories? And so I just decided to flip it with this book. And I made the stories prominent and then the facts and figures and research and theory in the background.
Well, cool. So there is a backstory about these stories now. I can't wait to hear you talk about one of the stories. I'm going to ask you to maybe just pick one story from, you know, the six major stories you presented in the book and gave us an overview or summary of the story about the family and students and what message you want to convey through telling the story.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, I love them all. It's like sure. My children, right?
Yeah.
I can't pick a favorite.
But there's no favorite, right?
Yeah. But there's a song lyric that I like, and it says, I cried when I wrote this song. And so I can say that I cried when I wrote this chapter.
Oh.
And this is chapter 3 about Josue.
Yeah.
And
the Mexico,
boy from the south of Mexico, Chiapas region, right, of Mexico. And it's very real to me. It's the longest story in the book. And it's very real to me because all of these stories are compilations of students either that I've worked with or that my students have worked with. My students who have gone on to be teachers have been really generous in letting me come out and visit and meet students over the years. So I'm staying in the game. And these are people who are such heroes that I'm talking about. And that really moves me. The mother, the teachers, the migrant advocate, those all are compilations of people that I've worked with who have done as much and more as what is in this story. So it moves me deeply. This is a story of a young boy who was born in the U.S. His parents were migrant farm workers, undocumented, and they struggled mightily with the financial insecurity, the transience of that lifestyle, and a struggle also between the parents about what the right path was for Josue and his sister. Josue came to a town where his family was able to stay put for a longer period of time than typically a migrant family could, because of a nursery there that needed them for more than just a season, but for the year round, which gave him an opportunity to really thrive in school. He had been moving around in and out of school, very difficult for him, not only to learn English, but just the gaps in his exposure to the curriculum and instruction were really detrimental to him. And he had this opportunity where his mother was pushing for being able to stay in this one place for his benefit, for his sister's benefit. And they did that. And I don't want to give away everything of the story, but
sure. That's a super delicate balance, you know.
Yes, yes, it is. Yeah. So the school that he was placed in was one that had a dual language program, and even at that school, as wonderful as that school was, there were questions about whether he, with his interrupted schooling and his literacy skills in either language that were well below grade level, whether he should be in the dual language program, because it was under scrutiny as a bilingual program in the community, whether it would be worth the funding that it required to have a program that used both languages. So the teachers were very protective of the program because they didn't want their test scores to be brought down by a student who was struggling. And one teacher went to bat for him. That was, you know, one of the points that made me cry, because I knew the teacher that had done that for a student like him and many others, and who said, why should we say no without giving something a try? And she was able to get him into dual language, and she was able to work with him. And there was a migrant advocate at the school who was an angel, you know, just an absolute angel. And she's based on a real person who is someone that I admire greatly. And stories like hers often don't get told. But if you ever feel down or feel that you're not getting credit for something you've done, you can think about Miss Julie and what she's done to make a difference in the lives of the migrant children that she works with, and the enormous successes that those students have had over time. Time and again, I have taught some of her graduates as they prepared to become teachers and went back to the migrant community. So I wanted to feature the heroics of the teachers, of the migrant advocate, of the mother who fought for her son, and the community as a whole who valued bilingualism and who found a way to enable Josue to thrive. So that's my favorite story.
Amazing. I read that story. I mean, I don't want to say more about it, because I really hope that our audience could really just go there and read the story themselves. But it's really a touching story. And well, you were talking about that, you know, the whole story just made me think of recently, just because of the COVID pandemic and everything related with school disruption, there is this larger scale, maybe societal level, anxiety from parents and teachers and maybe policymakers about, oh, what shall we do? Our kids have been so left behind, you know, because of the, you know, all kinds of disruptions. And then I've seen people starting to talk about, you know, look at those immigrant families, their experience, and to like think about really like we have a lot of expertise in terms of like we have a lot of knowledge about how to cultivate continuity and stability, sustainability. Mm-hmm. And also I feel like the whole society should just, you know, learn if there's anything we could learn from the learning disruption that, for example, my kid experienced. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I feel like I should be just a more sympathetic or more supportive of their education.
Yes, yes. And I'll go back to Josue's story, Miss Julie. And this is very true. And it, I guess part of writing the book during the pandemic gave me an opportunity to address some of these things. She went out in, in a van with hotspots to different residences that didn't have internet to make sure that these students could stay current with their work. And it was just such a struggle, like you said, for families for whom English is not their home language, for them to learn, for their children to learn remotely, because it's already difficult in the classroom to get teachers who have a small number of English learners in their classrooms to teach in an accessible way to them, to make sure that they're providing visual support, that they're demonstrating things, doing things that connect language to nonverbal communication. And that becomes even harder if you're teaching on Zoom or you're giving a lot of assignments on Canvas, you know, a learning platform. And we saw a lot of backsliding with English learners during this period of time. So that's been something we've been working on, my colleagues and I, in putting together resources for parents and also for teachers and directly for students to help them continue to develop proficiency in their home language and in English, and to have access to the curriculum with support for them to understand the content. And I think that's an ongoing thing. We should have been doing that before the pandemic. That would have been a wonderful way to provide enhancement and extend what we can do in the classroom. So maybe that's an upside of this, that there's a lot more focus on improving how we do remote learning and opening up opportunities for students to have support through remote learning that didn't exist before. So I'm offering one positive outcome from the pandemic.
Yeah. So it sounds like the disconnection here seems to be as students go back to their homes and they rely on their parents at least those younger students, they rely on their parents for assistance in remote learning. And I don't know, how much parents could help if parents themselves are still struggling with English communication, and how much schools are being proactive in reaching out to those families and parents.
Yes, I did a study with colleagues in hospitality. And we interviewed 19 human resource managers at major hotels about their language policies and how they supported employees who worked there who weren't proficient in English. And our research showed really clearly that not only did the workers there who were adults who had many children in K through 12 or PK through 12 schools in the area, the research showed that they needed support in acquiring English to be able to be promotable, to be able to even be versatile in their jobs. But they also needed support related to technology. And often the support that the companies provided for English were technology-based. So it was like a double barrier for them. They're like, here, you can do the Rosetta Stone, or you can do this or that. And so it's really clear that we have to think about potential barriers when we deal with families, and ensure that we provide ways for them to reach over those barriers and access what they need.
That's so cool. And thinking of where you where you live right now and where you work, I realized that perhaps it's a really good location to study the hospitality industry.
Yeah, yeah, that was a fun and interesting study to do. And there was just a whole spectrum of awareness among hotels as to the assets that their immigrant workers offered to them.
I see. Yeah. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's a really interesting side story in relation with this story about this young boy. You know, I think in I still want to talk a little bit more about those stories because I just can't stop thinking of them. But for each of the stories, you have suggested some activities for readers to engage in. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about those activities, because like I feel like those things are particularly helpful for me when I was reading the book. I noticed some of the plots, but I don't really know, you know, for example, hey, this teacher is using some specific strategy or pedagogy to intervene, or there is a different program, etc.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the stories are across all of them. They address a planned array of issues that are important for educators. And I think really anyone in public service, I think it's applicable to them as well. And they were seeded with these details. And the idea is that the reader has an opportunity to dig into these details and analyze them. So the stories aren't telling you, okay, this is about this and that's about that, and you need to learn about this. They're showing you what is happening when the teacher does this. You know, this is what happens in this story, and you can see either the wonderful benefit of the decision made or the maybe not so wonderful outcome. And so that was meant to create a reflection in this analysis and also discussion. So I have written books before, and I have read books that have questions at the end of each chapter, and they just seem kind of standard sort of questions. But the question, I worked really hard on the questions at the end because I wanted to, there's so much fodder for thought and discussion from the details of the stories that I wanted to help the reader engage with that. And I wanted to help the reader apply so many of these details to the context that the reader is teaching in or providing services to these communities in. So it's sort of a give and take, put the details in the stories to elicit thought and reflection, and then have questions that heighten that and enable discussion and hopefully then application.
So it sounds like it's a really helpful book for teachers, educators. I'm just wondering, like, you know, for other people wearing other hats, for example, you know, just for a general audience or reader or policymakers or, you know, parents, community leaders. I wonder, you know, what are some of the things they can get from this book?
Yes. Yeah. I have thought a lot about broadening who would read this. And I think stories lend themselves to that, right? If this was a textbook on teaching these students, there's only a limited number of people that would apply to, but this is bringing up so many different facets of this immigrant experience and the additional complication of or complexity of learning the language while learning the new systems, while learning the culture, while resettling, all these things. So I think that could benefit many different professionals, many different people who might want to know more about immigrants' in our country and in this community. I hope it's an accurate and, again, compassionate and gentle portrayal of their lives, and that it causes this kind of reflection for readers wherever they're at, whatever their focus is. I do have a plan, and you get to be kind of the first to hear about a new application of this book. This is the first I've shared. We just received a small grant. I'm working with a theater company.
Oh, cool. Wow.
And we're going to be doing a performance. We got funding to do one performance and handpick an audience for feedback. A performance of Lorena's story, the last story in the book. And it will have actors. Lorena is from Venezuela. And so it will have actors from Venezuela reading the dialogue of the different characters in character. So the younger voices, the older voices. And we're going to have pauses in the performance to stop and allow not only discussion, but also expression in other ways of how the stories resonated with the audience. And so it could be different things for different audiences. We're going to start with educators, but that could go to different groups, you know, counselors, public servants of different kinds. So that's one thing that I'm going to be working on with my colleague, Nadia Garzon, who has a theater company called Descolonizarte Teatro. And it's a bilingual theater company that I'm very excited about working with. We submitted another grant to take the stories of the book, again, with Nadia, and bring in a counselor. It's a mental wellness grant. And we submitted a project where we would do something similar with adults who are immigrants, who are at an advanced level of English proficiency, taking adult ESL classes. They would use this book, and we would have mental health resources, talking about the stresses of immigration, using issues brought up by the stories that they can connect with to talk about their own stresses and difficulties and resources. And we can provide information about resources to help with that. And we're going to be using an approach that Augusto Boal, who is the author of The Theater of the Oppressed, developed.
Mm-hmm.
Called
it. Yeah, I see. Yeah.
You're familiar with him?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's very well known. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Using an aesthetic process where just in case they are these adult ESL learners would like other means of expressing besides language, we're going to have opportunities for them to create arts and crafts that bring up their own stories, issues, obstacles they've faced, goals that they have that are all sparked from our reading the story, unpacking the story, and discussing aspects of the story, and then letting them make the story related to their own story.
Wow, that's so wonderful. And I can totally see here this connection of this expansion of the project in terms of getting more people involved. Because like one question, it actually occurred to me when I was reading the book was that I felt like the teachers were doing so much more than they were expected to do or they were asked to do. Like, for example, in the first one or two stories, I was seeing the teachers, they reached out to the parents and they introduced jobs to like one teacher specifically introduced a parent, an immigrant parent, a job that mm-hmm. is in the school. And yes. then like they were trying to raise money or finding resources to say install the security system for a family who, a refugee family who were suffering from some of the previous violent experience. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, given the kind of workload the teachers are having nowadays and the challenges of the work, like I was wondering, like, how come they could do so much, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll first say that I think you can tell by now that I'm a huge proponent for dual language programs. And so in situations where a school has a thriving dual language program, it really isn't just one individual, the one teacher who is marshaling all these resources, but it really is a team effort. There are others that are ready to respond. And those things are all true that you just mentioned. Those are things that I witnessed happening. But I've also seen teachers come together with their own networks and get a used car for a parent who couldn't get the child to school on wow. time or regularly because the child was within the 2-mile limit where they couldn't take a bus. Right. So I think that teachers have wonderful networks and they rely on each other and family members and members of other groups that they belong to call in for help when things are needed. With the case of Dibanesha and the teacher helping with getting an alarm system, the teacher was connected with the social service, which was the refugee resettlement agency, highest that could make connections to find resources too. So I think that's a message of the book that, you know, the saying, it takes a village, that teachers that are connected to the village and that know these resources can be a conduit for these families in both directions, for the agencies that provide these things and for the parents that need these things. So it's not just the teachers alone. There are very few lone actors. They're usually, you know, connected to a network of really caring individuals who want to help.
Yeah, no, I can see this. And I can see, honestly, I think after reading the stories that make me really rethink the role of those teachers, you know, not only as the person who interact with students on a daily basis to teach and to engage with them academically, but how much more a teacher can offer.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I get emails and texts and calls from former students who are teaching, who are putting out a call, you know, has anybody got a used this or that, you know, these students need it. As I talked about Miss Julie, she had a connection at the airport that where she was able to get the snacks that they were going to throw out from the airplanes after so many days. And every week she drove to the airport and picked those up and took them to the school so those children could have snacks. You know, we all do things in our lives to be a good citizen, to help others. And teachers often spend a lot of their goodwill and good efforts on their own students and their own school and families at their own school. I think there's many, many unsung heroes among teachers. They don't brag about these things, but you find out about it and you just feel happy that you've chosen this profession.
And this book is really a love letter for them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with that said, I want to ask you, you know, we have been talking for a while about the book, and I want to ask you what you are working on right now. Like you mentioned some of the ideas to expand the stories or like to reach out to more people.
Yes, yes. Well, that definitely is in the works. And I'm working with a number of colleagues in different disciplines, and I'm working with a variety of school districts and schools on a family and community engagement project that will better link the school with these different communities through something that we're calling the Bilingual Village. And this is simply a network of brick and mortar and virtual businesses, agencies, organizations that promote and celebrate bilingualism and that are welcoming to those who are learning any of the languages that are spoken in those establishments. At the school, we prepare the students for going out into the community and using their new language in a welcoming environment where these students are identified as speak to me in English or habla conmigo en español, speak with me in Spanish. And they go into these establishments where the employees also have, the participating employees have badges that say which languages that they can be addressed in. And so the students get to practice using the language that they're learning, and their parents get to practice. They go together as a family and they get to practice the language in an encouraging environment. Too often for those of us that are learning another language, when we go into the community and try to use it, people are impatient with us, or we feel intimidated to use the language if we're not strong in the language and we know they're busy. And so these are places and spaces where second language learners from all backgrounds and different languages can go and expand their knowledge and use of the language in a friendly environment.
Wow, that sounds very exciting. So this is more like a program building instead of a book project, right?
Yes, this program building, and we're going to be doing research on the language use, actual cool. Conversation analysis on the students' use of language and the parents' use of language in these different venues. There's been research done in Iceland that we're modeling this on. Something called the Icelandic Village, and we changed it to the Bilingual Village. but we're really excited about it. We've had a few pilots, and it's gone well. We had some, of course, pauses from the pandemic that made us do everything online. But we're getting back out into the community, and there's a fluidity now between some of these businesses and the school that and the parents that patronize these businesses that didn't exist before. So we're excited about that. Yes, so books, I'm not working on a book right now, but at some date, I am going to write a book about my experiences in Italy as an Italian learner.
You know why I'm asking about book, right? Because like we are eager to have our book authors to join us in the new books interview. All I want to know is like, when can we have you again?
Oh, that's so nice. I appreciate that. Yeah, I really have for a long time wanted to write about my own experiences through storytelling, through this type of writing, which is something that I've had to learn over the years, this kind of showing mostly and a little bit of telling type of storytelling, also sometimes called creative nonfiction. So right. I would like to do the same for my own story because I think it sheds light on, I've told my story to many, many people in presentations and conferences. And I always have people coming up after saying, you know, I'm born speaking English. I've never thought about what that was like, but then I could see myself in you. If something like that happened to me, I would feel exactly the same, and I would have the same struggles. And that's what my students are experiencing. I never thought about it that way. So I think there would be value in my sharing that experience and how it has driven my passion for this discipline, for these students, for this work.
Absolutely. And we look forward to having you again one day after you publish this wonderful book. It sounds like a memoir. And, you know, with that, I feel like we are completing a perfect circle in terms of, like, we started with talking about your own story, and then we shift to the stories in the book, and now we come back to your plan to write about your story. So it's just so wonderful to have you here today, Joyce, and thanks again. It's really a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking with you. Thank you for your excellent questions.
Yeah, all the very best with your project, the programs, and future book writing.
I appreciate it.